Beam community podcast listeners, are you new to virtualization and data protection? If so, check out Backup Academy. Beam has sponsored Backup Academy to provide web-based training and certification resources for virtualization and data protection technologies. We've also launched a new session from Greg Shields, multi-site clustering for Hyper-V disaster recovery. Check out this track and more at backupacademy.com.
Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 54, What Happens Under the Hood. Here we go. Today my guest is Rob Kuhn. How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing well and good.
You are my man. We go way back, everyone. This man is good people. I'm telling you that. He is good stuff. Rob, thank you so much for being on the show. This is a professional publication, but we are going to be laughing a lot on this one.
That's right. I'm glad to be here, man. Like you said, we go way back, and I'm looking forward to shedding my light on things as best I can.
And that's great. And I think what we're going to talk about today is, you know, the under-the-hood stuff, right? Not so much you, but I guess me, we look at stuff, we buy stuff, and I don't know what happens on the circuitry, the electrical engineering level. So, Rob, can you give us a good bio about yourself, kind of, you know, big picture, what do you work on, what do you know? Because I know that you're the right person to talk about this stuff.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm glad to. Yeah, so I'm an electrical engineer that specializes in what they call VLSI. That's an acronym for Very Large Scale Integration. And that basically just says you do a lot of stuff with lots of little tiny parts called transistors. So basically, yeah, I work under the hood designing microprocessors of all types and sorts. I've spent 10 years in the industry up in New England doing so, working for various companies around here that do everything from big general processors to things that go slightly more specific than general processors. So, you know, a lot of people doing software stuff, they worry about what I like to call the ones and zeros, the bits. Mm-hmm. I'm the guy working on the hardware. I do the resistors, capacitors, or the R's and C's.
Ah, the R's and C's complements the ones and zeros. That's the birth of a nerd joke right there. I love it.
That's it. Yeah, the ladies don't, though, you know, so that's always the problem.
So, Rob, I hear this term floating around. I won't lie, it ends up in marketing material, but I don't know the difference. That's why I'm talking to you. I hear this term called an ASIC, right, versus a mainstream processor. I know what a mainstream processor is. It's something like an Intel, right, a Xeon, right? What is an ASIC, and how are they different?
So, again, you know, one of the things about the this world, as you well know, is acronyms are abound everywhere. Mm-hmm. ASIC, we'll expand it out. ASIC stands for it's Specific Integrated Circuit. So basically what it is compared to a general processor, as you talk about the difference. You know, with general processor, it can be used for anything. Like, you know, you fire up your Xeon, like you mm-hmm. mentioned, you're going to run your browser, you're going to run your video game, you're going to run your spreadsheet, things like that. The ASIC, and I missed the A on that, which is application-specific integrated circuit. Yeah. So that is something that's it's just what it says. They make this for a very specific purpose. So, you know, you might have something. A great example is how we're communicating right now. In your cell phone, which I presume we're on some fancy smartphone, I certainly am, you have ASICs all over the place in there that do everything from, you know, the actual processor, which you've got a little computer in there, to your transceiver that's driving the communication in and out of the thing. Those are a couple good examples, but another set of examples goes a lot lower level, you know, things that run control planes for, like power plants or something like that. You know, people build in embedded ASICs to do all that kind of stuff. So basically, the application fits the need, and you've got a team that puts something like that together. So those are it's basically general to specific, and those are the differences between the two.
Okay, so like a purpose-built processor would be kind of what the ASIC would function as. And in my case, I'm calling you on Skype, okay? So I'm on my PC, so I've got an internet card going over the internet, and Skype magic, whatever, lets me call phone numbers. So at least the $2.99 a month I give them lets me call phone numbers. And so in this case, like the network card that I use probably has ASICs on it, right? It doesn't have a big Mama Xeon just to push packets over the wire. That would be overkill. It could probably do it, but it would be underutilized.
Or actually,
maybe would it not be as good as an ASIC in something like that?
Well, that's an interesting question. Here's the rub. So the line between what you might call an ASIC and a general purpose processor is pretty smudged. It's especially nowadays, technology, as you know, technology every year, it actually expands at a geometric rate, which is kind of scary when you think about it. Mm-hmm. But heck, as a small aside, go back to when we were kids playing on the old Atari to the mm-hmm. Nintendo and all that good stuff, and look at the capabilities we have now. So something that, you had this, very specific thing. Here's a great example, a video card. Video cards were, almost like co-processors. They were very specific. They had a very specific need, to produce video for your display. Mm-hmm. These video cards nowadays are so powerful that they actually use these things. They're still co-processors, but they actually use them to offload math functions from your general processor when the video is idle on the darn things. So there's a great sort of smudge on the line of when you have this very specific need to general need because of just the sheer power you can produce out of any processor nowadays.
So from a whole system or solution standpoint, I guess another factor that rolls in is unit cost, right? If you're talking about, let's just say, non-extreme video, generic, the way I do video, I'm still good with 1 mega RAM, by the way. My video.
Good man.
I don't game. I do virtualization, and VMware lets me say I can put video RAM on there, but I never do it anyways. But, if I've got a solution, right, I've got network, and I've got USBs and, stuff on the motherboard, and I.O. controllers, right, SATA controllers, stuff like that. It comes to be that you don't want to pay, nothing against Intel or AMD, but you don't want to pay them every step of the way, right? So then it becomes like a purpose-built solution, right, for the whole system, and there's a lot of engineering that goes over this, and we're definitely at a super high level here, but it sometimes becomes a practicality standpoint. Am I right in that?
That, absolutely. That's a great point. Price is king everywhere, and it certainly stands to reason in the microprocessor world. Absolutely. There's a couple things you need to consider when as a company looking to buy something that fulfills some need. Mm-hmm. So, you want to talk about some very specific thing that handles simple operations versus a general processor that could probably handle those and a dozen more things. Cost is absolutely essential. But there's another piece as well that sort of folds into cost. It's also power consumption. And this is absolutely mm-hmm. huge nowadays, and getting more important all the time. Mm-hmm. So I remember back in the days when I first started in the industry, we were designing general purpose processors that were going into your Cray supercomputers. The Alpha chip is one of the ones that I had an experience to help work on. They built the computers that cracked the human genome a number of years ago, so they need some high powered computes. But power consumption was not a concern. They're like, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just... people were paying top dollar for machines as long as they could compute and compute fast. Performance, mm-hmm. performance, performance. So, but now somebody that wants to put something in their cell phone that, that has a battery and all they need to do is a couple very, very specific things and do it very well. They sure as heck don't want to spend, a few hundred dollars on a processor, to your point on cost. And also, they sure as hell don't want something that, as soon as they flip the phone on, 3 minutes later, it's dead because the processor sucked the power dry out of the battery. So both those things are extremely important. And like I mentioned, they're getting more important all the time. So it's a fascinating divide that really, is you had just described, that sort of widens the gulf between your ASIC and your general purpose processor.
Well, and the other thing that I think is happening, right, the cell phone's a great example, by the way, because it's a weird balance because we want all the features, one of which is that the device is small, right? You remember the ones we used to carry where there was like a purse for the battery? Oh, it was wicked. I remember my mom had one. It had this like, oh, God. It was like I'd use both hands and carry the thing. It was sick. But
think the old Michael Douglas movie, Wall Street. Yeah. There's a scene in there where he's got the battery pack and the huge cell phone on the beach, and that was high technology back in the day.
It was, but, again, you wanted all the functionality, and that was the capability of the era. Flip that to today, The other problem that we all deal with, and I think is what we call sprawl. Okay, so in terms of sprawl, you know, this is something that I deal with. It's server and storage sprawl. I'll go back to my infrastructure practice 15 years ago, more years ago, and literally everything was on one server, right? I was in the Novell Netware era. But the thing is, people want more servers and storage, and then we filled up every room we had with computers. Then we virtualized, and we reduced our footprint, but we still have a lot of stuff. So back to that power issue, I'm all in the virtualization realm, but I still deal with that power management issue. In fact, there's this one feature that VMware has called distributed power management, which is, it's actually a very novel idea. What it does is if you're not using your server, and like at work, I've got a pool of 15 of them. And if it's not using it, it sends it the power down signal. And when it's time to wake up, it tells it to power up, right? So, you know, it's a very kind of night and day, right? If you're here and you're using it, it's online. If not, it's off. So I want to twist this a little bit. Aside from power, right, I always worry about interference, right? So especially like on cables that go outside of a system, right? There's a certain amount of crosstalk that goes on signaling. Do I ever have to worry about that, like on board for, you know, systems and cards? And
no, you bet you do. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I remember there was a computer farm that was out somewhere high up. I think it was out west somewhere in the United States. High elevation, so they were exposed to what they call alpha particles to a larger degree than most of us experience down at sea level or closer to it. And what an alpha particle is just some basically bit of noise. It's not a subatomic particle. It's just a small particle that can actually impact your computers. They can impact your chips, and they impact them at high speed. And what they do is they actually cause the very disruption you're describing, where they can basically create enough what we like to call in the industry noise that can fool your little tiny processor to thinking that it has a value it's trying to compute, to make it a slightly different value that it's computing, and thus you have major errors on downstream that can cause cataclysmic failure in whatever you're running. It's big, and it is important. And as a matter of fact, the larger the processor, it's basically, you think of it like a net. The bigger the net, the more likely that you're going to have one of these particles that can cause said damage. And they've taken it seriously, and they're taking it more seriously all the time. Now, there's things you can do to fix that. As a matter of fact, coincidentally, I'm working on a circuit right now that handles some corrections when you get an error. There's all sorts of things like this that you can do to sort of detect an error, mm-hmm. and in some cases actually repair the error. So there's several ways you can make redundant circuits, sort of like a majority vote thing. You know, two out of three say it's one value, and the error may say it's another value, so majority counts. But it plays with probabilities that way. So you're just betting that you're not going to get too many errors, so you might be able to recover. Another thing is called error correction code, ECC.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's been around for a long time. And it works, you know, but they have these schemes where they call single bit error correct and double bit error detect. So basically they say is that you can fix one error, but if you get another error, they're throwing the flag up and saying, I quit. And you have what they call it, the I'm screwed flag. So your processor shuts down. But it is a big problem, absolutely. And it's been there for a long time. It'll continue to be there. And the good news is it's a manageable problem.
You know, there's a YouTube video out there somewhere, and this might be just a good way to you'll say, heck yeah, at the R's and C's level, right? It's kind of hard to, like, narrate a YouTube video, but here we go, okay?
My buddy.
If anyone can do it, it's me, all right? So, okay, there's a dude in a data center, and he's looking at a rack full of equipment, all right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a disk array, and the disk array is running some, like, you know, just all in SQL query or something, right? It's being hammered away. In this case, the RAID controllers are just banging away at this whole rack full of disks, okay?
Yeah.
And over on this monitor, the guy has, I'm not making this up, I'm going to have to find this, and I will put this YouTube video in the podcast notes.
Post it, yeah.
But anyways, over on the monitor behind him, the guy has a performance tracker screen, right, that is monitoring the I.O. performance of his storage system.
Yeah.
So he goes up to the storage system and just shouts as loud as he can, ah, you know? And, like, over on the screen, there is a dip in performance. So, like, noise interference, which is a vibration, right, which would interfere on a rotating disk, absolutely. Right?
You bet.
You know, so don't go jamming to heavy metal in your data center, I guess, is the takeaway.
And don't have any strong magnets in your pockets.
You talked about some of the logic that you put into the R's and C's, right? And that's a perfect segue, Robin, to the next thing I want to talk about.
You know, and
you see this phenomenon too, right? You've got Moore's Law, right, which is the exponential performance increase you talked about.
Absolutely.
Well, is that the theory you're referencing, or was there a different
one? It is.
Okay.
It is, and that has tons of ramifications.
Yeah.
But there's an interesting thing to say about Moore's Law. It's funny that they call it a law. It's not really a law. As a matter of fact, we're starting to reach, and I'm sure you've heard this for a long time, that we're starting to reach sort of the limit of the advantages or the performance gains we can get out of the materials that we currently build most processors, both ASIC and general purpose alike. So in really actually starting to see this, typically what had happened in history is that they would do something called a shrink. And so you could take one design that's made out of these you know, microscopic switches, transistors, and you can take it to the, you can build the same design, but they make it with a set of materials that allow for smaller dimensions. What that did is basically, for a switch, it had the input and output of the switch brought closer together because it's smaller, which increased the speed of that switch.
Mm.
And your computer basically, they're just composed of millions, hundreds of millions of these switches. So you got major performance gains because of that alone. Now we're starting to see days where you're getting to the levels of these switches where they're actually, you know, you can count the number of atoms that comprise one dimension of the switch. You can actually count them. It's not, you know, in the millions or whatever. We're talking, you know, double the single digits here.
Wow.
And so it's amazing. It really is. And I've been in this industry for a while, and it still fascinates me to see some of this stuff. But so you're having a problem. You're reaching a limit that, you know, eventually you're going to get down to a level where you can't split the atom, or you're going to have other problems other than
yeah,
the noise.
Yeah. I don't want to have that problem in my data center.
That's right. Exactly.
That's right.
That's an issue.
The first scenario brought up, is that what I call round-trip latency?
No.
Or is that something else?
So latency applies to more of an architectural thing.
Okay.
And I have to say, I would like to spend a minute on that just to describe. So any listeners out there, you know, there's a lot of performance measures about computers that are sort of ignored in the marketing. Like you mentioned, you know, up in front, like just there's a lot of sort of glossing over things, high level things. Mm-hmm. One of the things you might see all over the place is frequencies. You look at the processors, you look at something to buy for general purpose, all you see is frequency, frequency, frequency.
Right.
That and disk size. But frequency is one of the big levers. And you'll see Intel advertise some X gigahertz processor and things like that.
Yeah.
So that's nice. That's great. And certainly that is a measure of a computer's performance, but that's not the only measure of its performance. And it should really be denoted for that. There's other big measures. A lot of it has to do with what you do with that frequency. It's down to the computer architecture, and that's where, to your point, latency comes from. Latency refers to how fast you can get something from a computer's memory back to the processor that uses that memory for something. You can think of it like a library. Let's say I'm going to use a Hennessy and Patterson analogy. If you're in a library and you have a desk and you're trying to do a research paper, you're on a desk at the library, and you need to go get a book from somewhere on those shelves. You've got to go run across the hall and get this book and run it back to your desk and actually do something with it. Mm-hmm. So that's a latency for memory. And there's all types of architectural schemes that improve that latency so that you can bring those books closer to you so you have them in access sooner. And that's where you might have referred to, you might see on, again, the specs for a processor, something called a cache.
Right.
So a cache just allows you to bring maybe a smaller subset of those books that you might need a little closer to you so you don't have to go run down that same hallway and get a new book every time. So that's sort of what you're talking about with latency and round-trip latency.
Yeah, because whenever we buy, let's just focus on a device, right, a processor, a disk, or a controller, we're lucky if we can get, you know, 4 stats easily, right? And take a disk, right? It's rotational speed, size, and maybe a cache, and then the interface, right? That's about the 4 specs you get. So,
sure,
and there's
yeah.
always more, right? And I don't know if you've ever been in the circles, right, where the term commodity equipment comes up, right? And
sure.
I've done a lot of hanging around with some of the largest electronic, you know, conglomerates in the world, and they take they make every component, right? Disk, controller, computer, they make the whole stack, and then they'll go on and say that it makes a difference to have that, you know, that engineering go all the way up and down, and I think that there's certain truth to that. But the other thing that I worry about, Rob, is that the software is getting so dang smart on some of these things, right? So just as Moore's Law is taking off like crazy, and when I say software, I'm talking R's and C's software, but I'm also talking about, you know, management software, right? Stuff that sits on top of hardware. What do you think about that? Is that, yeah, that's good that it's getting smart, but, you know, it has to be in check with the hardware? What's your take on that?
Well, I think that what happened, and there's always been, again, this is another one of those blurry lines. There's always been this balance between what software does and what hardware does. And I've seen trends. It's interesting that you say that it's sort of the analog to what I've seen in different parts of our industry. You see a line where software, like I'll say, here's a good example, like a certain function, multiplication. In history, multiplication was done a lot in software. You'd have very limited hardware resources that would you would have to use creatively to perform a multiplication algorithm to get a number multiplied. But nowadays, with sort of the abundance of transistors that we can lay down on a chip and the architectural improvements that we've made, you can do that whole algorithm, that whole multiplication algorithm in hardware purely and do it really, really fast. So there's been a dividing line, and I think that line moves to this day, depending on whatever your application mm-hmm. is you're interested in. But the software, so sort of this, you know, this intelligent software, it doesn't surprise me at all. But I think the reason you have such creative software is solely because of the fact that the hardware underneath has gotten a lot more complicated as well. There's a lot more you can do with it.
So the phenomena I see is that software gets bloated, right, at the expense of all this quote-unquote real estate that's been made available from the overperforming hardware at an accelerating rate. I'll take just name any piece of software that we use every day, right? A browser, an operating system, a word processing app. The way that Rick Vanover, Rickatron uses that stuff right now in 2012 is not much different than he did probably 20, 30, what, I don't know how many years ago. And I know that it fit on 5-6 floppies back then, right?
That's right.
And there's no stinking way today. So there's these parallel worlds that are, I like to, it's almost like a Tron race game, right? Where one's taking the lead and the other one cuts the other one off. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Yes, absolutely. It's frustrated a lot of us who design these things as well, this overcomplexity. You know, and it's funny, I think that's almost, not to venture into too much philosophy, but I almost think that's sort of the human way. It's like you get more power under the hood, well, you're going to use it somehow. And people start thinking, well, wow, look at all the bells and whistles we can add here because we have the functionality. As opposed to back in the day, you remember, heck, I remember having a Tandy 1000 computer that didn't have any disk at all. It had like, you know, a kilobyte of memory or something like that. It was, you know, it was super tiny. And people had to be very creative and Spartan with how they use that. Those days are gone. And so they find new and interesting ways to use this stuff. And, you know, you'll pull up a spreadsheet software that has so many buttons and bells and whistles on it that you're like, all I want to do is figure out how to add two numbers, and I can't find a button to do that anymore because it's buried under all this this graphic smorgasbord. So, but again, I feel like that's sort of the human thing. You know, you build a more powerful car, people are going to find ways to use that thing.
It's not just humans, Rob. It's goldfish. Don't you know? Goldfish will only grow to as big as their bowl.
That's it.
Telling you, we just got to look at the koi pond and we get the scrap figured out. Man.
That's it. That's the analogy. I'm humbled by the Zen. That's it, man. Exactly.
Gotcha.
We're goldfish designing these things.
We only live in our bowl.
Absolutely.
Give me a bigger bowl, I'll be a bigger fish.
It's true.
Awesome.
And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the gaming thing. I've seen some of these games that are out there nowadays, and they just absolutely blow me away. So it's interesting, and I'd love to make this point. It fascinates me. One of the beautiful examples of this creativity thing that's changed in its role is a video game. Back in the early days, we're talking even like 70s and earlier, there were video games, but what they were is people like from MIT would write these things like Pong, and they would really try to put an emphasis on kinematic physics, for example, to make some realistic way how something might bounce around. Nowadays, this emphasis with so much more power, it's been focused into graphics, and this goes back to sort of our graphical horsepower, video card type thing. Not so much necessarily in real simple physics, but just producing the best quality video that you possibly can, which has its own math associated as well. But it's sort of a different role. You need a really high horsepower engine that can process a lot of algorithms, and you need a lot of disk space. Fit all this stuff.
And quick disk space, too, because a lot of times those I.O. patterns aren't staying in one spot. They're very random, so that's a storage array nightmare sometimes. So,
sure it is.
Rob, this has been outstanding material. I hope that people kind of get a little bit of a better feel about some of the under-the-hood components that goes on with stuff we use every day, right? You know, storage controllers, network interfaces, servers, and all that stuff, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
This has been awesome.
There's a lot to talk about, so, you know, anytime you guys want any more information, I'll give you what limited bit I know.
I'll be calling you every Monday night if you say that, you know.
I'm here, brother. Anytime.
All right. Remember, everyone, I said he's good people. He is, all right. So, Rob, I'm going to transition to my official gimmick of my podcast. And that's called Three Views from You. I'm going to ask you three questions, each set in a different point of time. Let's start with the past. So, Rob, can you share with me any technology experience in your personal life or your work experience, anything in the past that was a good technology story that would be something you could share with us?
Absolutely. So, this is a good one, at least from my perspective. So, when I was a young teenager, I'll go back to the video game storyline. I was just enamored by some of the computer video games that were out there. The first-person perspective ones that had first come out around the time. I was fascinated so much, but I had to know how they worked.
Yeah.
I had to know how is it that this box that I plugged in somehow and configured through software could produce something that is so cool. So that actually pushed me, motivated me to get into engineering and figure that out. So that actually motivated me to go to school and get an electrical engineering degree with a specialization in VLSI. So, it's all from, hey, this is awesome. I love playing this thing. How do I build something that can do that?
Yeah, it was Red Baron. I was there, dude. I remember.
Oh, the Red Baron. I was thinking about that today. Exactly. Let me tell you, folks. This guy is the Red Baron. Stay away from him with a red fighter plane.
Well, I was thinking that you actually figured out a way to hack the game or something, because I was doing things that was breaking all kinds of flight rules. that's what I remember. So,
those were your talents alone, my friend. You took that thing and gave those controllers a run for their money.
Yeah, the good thing we didn't have an internet back then. They would have like called home and said, "Man, this isn't right."
You mean that, like the time you tried to email your hard drive?
Oh, we're not going to talk about that. And everyone, it is true. Okay, I'm not going to deny it. This guy's got all the dirt on me. All right, next question. Okay, Rob. Also, I forgot. You know, I've done 54 of these, and I've never messed it up this bad. So, Rob, what's going on right now in the present, technology-wise, that you have the most passion for today?
That's a good question. That's actually a really tough question because I'm enjoying it all. I happen to be in a unique position right now with the company I'm working on that sort of is straddling a divide with where the technology is moving to how you actually build these things, these processors, both ASIC and general processor alike. So I have a world where it's sort of the old world of doing things where you do it full custom. You're literally tweaking small individual parameters and individual transistors and understanding intimately the physics behind them to get every bit of performance you can out of them. But those days are changing. They're going. It's moving to a more of an automated world. And so that's also an interesting field. There's a lot of it's just a different way to solve the same problem, really. And so as an engineer, we just love to tinker with things. And so you find new problems in trying to solve the same problem, I guess you could say. You know, you're using a different skill set to do these things. So I'm passionate about both. I love the fact that, you know, it's sort of what brought me into this, sort of what's really going on down at the transistor level, down in the actual physics of the thing. I love that world, but I'm also really enjoying this, you know, this sort of you're taking a step above it, and you're solving larger problems to get bigger chips done and faster.
Oh,
so,
Rob,
you know, I'm passionate about it all.
That's crazy because I definitely appreciate that knobs and dials approach, you know,
mm-hmm.
that low-level approach. But that is exactly the issue that the common IT pro, the typical listener to this podcast, is dealing with, because it's that influx of cloud computing, right? We used to have this stuff all on our own, and we had the knobs and dials, and we could be very granular. And I'm not saying there's no control, but we had full control in the private, you know, infrastructure. In this, some of these cloud models, I think the balance of what you manage versus what you control is swayed a little bit more to the manage side versus control side.
I gotcha.
Very interesting you say that, because it's the same challenge, just a different flavor of ice cream in my profession. Outstanding.
I'm sure it is. And it goes back to performance, you know, or progress, I should say, rather, the other P word. It's just inevitable that things move this way as you get better and better about doing something, certain things. You know, again, it comes back to human ability. You just get better at building things.
Right.
So it's going to become more automated. It's going to be a shift in how you do it. But there will always be a need in every field for some type of specialization. You really need to eke out so much performance, larger problems, that you're always going to need somebody that's going to be intimate with those types of controls. And I think that's where we come in, brother.
For sure, for sure. How about into the future, Rob? What do you see coming down the pike technology-wise that you think that you're going to be most interested in a couple years from now?
Well, you know, I mean, this is probably, you know, beating a dead horse, but I really see this power and performance issue, which they are diametrically opposed of each other, really, really pushing more into the forefront. And with that being said, you know, the challenges and on optimizing that, you know, again, we'll go back to the smartphone or something, you know, to give you the super cool processor, but your battery lasts for 2 days, that type thing. And those things have always been a big challenge. There are going to be even bigger challenges in the future, and particularly as we move to different ways to try and build these processors, you know, back to the last point we were just talking about. So I'm looking forward to meeting those challenges and solving bigger and bigger problems, you know, more complex processors and things that go around it. You know, so that's what I'm gaming for in the future.
Rob, did you know that beating dead horses is illegal in 32 states?
Well, not in my state.
I just made that up. It's probably not nice, even if it's not illegal. So,
if it was, my wife would kill me. I can't even use that term around here. I should probably be quiet.
Well, I got to give props out to Rob, by the way. Congratulations, a new father. How old is she now?
She's 1 month as of yesterday. You believe that?
I believe it. If time flies, man. So welcome to the club. Big shout out to you for that. Rob, this has been this has been an amazing podcast. I think the listeners will really appreciate it. You know, we deal with all this different kit that has all this stuff inside of it, but we've had no clue really how it works. And every time we ask, right, who do we ask? We ask the guy selling it to us, right? So
right on.
They're going to tell
you,
oh,
help, man.
Yeah, you say you latch this thing up, it'll launch missiles for you, right? You know, it's like, no.
You know what they won't have, though, my friend, is the Red Baron video game.
I got to find a ROM for that. That would be awesome.
Got to be out there. It's got to be out there.
Boy. Awesome. Well, hey, Rob, you don't blog. That's okay. You're on Twitter, but you don't use it. That's okay. You're still
you
a smart guy.
I'm
mentioning you on Twitter. Nobody's saying, who's that guy? Nobody's saying anything, but that's all right. Maybe you'll return. Anyways. Hey, Rob, you're on Twitter at @Coon_Rob, but you don't use it, but that's okay.
I'm learning. I'm learning.
you were doing fine 2 years ago. What do you mean you're learning? Anyways, man, rock on. Great show. Thanks for being on the podcast, Rob.
It's my pleasure, Rick.